Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 G's in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
Meet Gary. Gary's about to become an Einstein in an instant.
Whoa, Einstein hair. I like it.
That's right, Gary, because you're using Salesforce powered by Einstein AI to connect data, predict business trends, generate personalized content, and wow customers.
I do feel a lot smarter.
Because you're not just Gary anymore. You're Gary, empowered by Einstein AI.
Did you hear that, team? I'm an Einstein.
Oh, can I get a selfie?
The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine.
Plus global business, finance, and tech news.
The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week. Big focal point this week, Fed's second monetary policy meeting of the year, raising interest rates by a quarter percentage point and signaling it's not finished hiking despite the risk of exacerbating a bank crisis that's roiled global markets. We'll have more on that in just a moment. Also ahead, a state of play as Vladimir Putin welcomes China's Xi Jinping to Moscow while the war in Ukraine grinds on. Plus, the CEO of identity management platform Okta on IT spending, and we've got a must-read story from our magazine team about what happens when chatbots get raunchy with their human companions. Yep, you heard right. All of that to come, we begin with our big backdrop this week, and that was the Fed meeting and continued vigilance over banks. With us, our Business Week Editors Roundtable, Markets and Finance Editor Pat Regnier, Economics Editor Christina Lindblad, and Bloomberg News Federal Reserve Reporter Matt Bosler. The trio joining me and Bloomberg's Mike Regan to break down the week that was.
So we were thinking not only about sort of like how big will the hike be, but what message is that going to send? And, you know, it gets into, Vulcan three-dimensional chess really fast. You know, it's like maybe the, you know, if he's worried about the banks, will he not do a hike at all? Or will, if he's worried about the banks, will he do a hike because he doesn't want to let people know that he's worried about the banks? Seems like we got kind of the Goldilocks hike, at least from the point of view of how upsetting the week was going to be. It seems like the hike we got was the one that sort of kept more things from happening, at least for the last couple of days.
Wait, did you say Vulcan three-dimensional chess? That a geek test, I think, is the... I don't remember that. That's from Star Wars? Or Star Trek?
Star Trek.
Star Trek, that's right. I may have gotten the number of dimensions of chess wrong.
Well, that's kind of the week that was. I mean, Christina, come on in on this. I mean, and, you know, we're going to bring Matt in just a moment. The U.S. Central Bank's so in focus, but we have several global central banks, you know, looking at inflation, looking at what's going on. It's been a busy, I feel like, week, and certainly last week, if you roll the European Central Bank into it.
Yeah, well, the ECB went out ahead of the Fed basically saying, you know, we can do price stability and financial stability at the same time. It's not a choice, and that, you know, they had the mandate, you know, to slay inflation. And I think the message this week was the same from the Fed. I found it interesting that going into the meeting, everyone's expectations were completely scrambled right up to it, you know, with, like, I think Goldman coming out saying, you know, no hike. I think Nomura maybe, like, saying, like, cut maybe as soon as this meeting. And then, though, after the meeting, it's like, and now we resume our regular programming in which Wall Street starts wishing for the pivot.
It was wacky. I feel like there were so many different scenarios. Matt Bosler, come on in. You follow the Fed, have followed the Fed here. You know, thinking about the week that was, what is top of mind for you?
Well, I think, you know, yesterday's Fed decision and Jerome Powell's press conference were really interesting because, you know, at first they announced a rate hike. Their projections didn't show much more tightening. Markets initially responded positively to that, but then, of course, they sold off pretty heavily near the end of the press conference and thereafter. And so I think the broad takeaway was just not necessarily a lot of confidence that The Fed is fully attuned to the risks out there right now. And if you look kind of under the hood of some of the projections they put out, there's also a bit more of an acceptance on their part of the potential downside risks here. You know, the way the economic projections they put out basically implicitly have a recession written into them now, whereas they didn't 3 months ago, the last time they issued projections. And so just that, you know, seeming willingness on the part of policymakers to allow those greater downside scenarios to materialize, especially right in the middle of a bit of a crisis in the banking system that in large part has been brought about by the aggressive rate hikes over the last year. You know, that's not necessarily exactly what Wall Street may have wanted to hear from the Fed yesterday.
Matt, I have a question. How much do you think the Fed, in advance of everything that happened with Silicon Valley Bank, anticipated that what they were doing could potentially have, you know, the effect of like breaking a bank? You know, I think we often think of when we talk about how rate hike works, we think of them as almost kind of pneumatic things. It's like, well, they're going to raise rates and that's going to like raise borrowing costs and it's going to sort of slow things down and make financial conditions tighter. But like anybody who remembers like the 1980s knows that like when you change interest rate regimes, like you can bust a bunch of financial institutions. We had a long savings and loan crisis through the 80s after this. Is this, was this part of their mental model for what might happen if they raise rates, that they could have an accident like this and that that is actually part of the mechanism? Or was this as much of a surprise to them as it was to us?
I think you have to assume that, you know, most or all Fed officials are very aware of the history that you're talking about, right? I mean, this is like kind of just Fed 101 for everyone inside the central bank on the one hand. On the other hand, there certainly was no public, you know, discussion of these risks, right? And the conversation has always been couched more in terms of the effect that tightening financial conditions would have on economic growth and labor markets and inflation and, you know, more of a linear kind of step change to tighter conditions leading to that slowdown in growth. You know, the other big thing that people have been talking about the last few weeks is that there was no rising interest rate scenario in the Fed's stress tests of the banks. So that's another place where that conversation seemingly was a little bit absent.
You know, Matt, as you know, I view all of these issues through the lens of the stock market mainly. And the story there is almost that the rate increase is almost an afterthought. What everyone instead is looking at is the extension of the Fed's balance sheet, you know, $150 some billion loaned out through the discount window. And you get people using the old pandemic era expression, money printer go burr, meaning, you know, the Fed is flooding the system with liquidity. And that's just a natural reaction is to buy stocks, buy crypto, buy risky assets. But to me, I feel like there's a big difference between what the Fed's doing now, extending 90-day loans to banks, versus quantitative easing when they were buying treasuries and mortgage-backed securities from banks, and that it's kind of a mistake to view the expansion of the balance sheet as having the same effect. I'm curious how you think about it.
Yeah, so, you know, the Fed wants to keep these two things separate, right? They want to be able to continue their balance sheet reduction program and also have these facilities that are temporarily expanding the balance sheet. And that was actually one of the things that, you know, was a little bit interesting about yesterday's decision. They didn't announce any plans to slow down or stop the pace of their balance sheet reduction program, right? They're still allowing these bonds that are on their balance sheet that are coming due every month to just roll off, which is having the effect of removing reserves from the banking system, even as they're temporarily adding them through these facilities. And a lot of analysts over the last 2 weeks have pointed out that, you know, this is kind of a counterproductive thing, and it would make sense for them to, you know, maybe temporarily halt the balance sheet reduction so as to be more in keeping with what they're doing on the emergency lending side. Now, interestingly, that was one of the things that came up near the end of the press conference when you started really seeing markets sell off after an initial positive reaction to the Fed decision, when Powell was asked whether it had even been discussed at the meeting that, you know, they might consider slowing the pace or stopping the pace of balance sheet reduction. He said that it wasn't something that had really been discussed at the meeting. And so just that, you know, very blunt, like it was not even on the table, I think, you know, potentially could have contributed a little bit to the overall turn in sentiment toward the end of the presser.
Christine, I saw you nodding your head in a big way.
No, I mean, I've liked the stuff that Matt's been doing. He's been writing about, you know, I think interestingly, the stuff about in the SCP in the latest round of economic projections, in which, you know, I mean, the Fed has been very careful not to say the word recession unless, you know, asked pointed questions about it. But like, you know, if you look at, you know, the GDP tracker the Atlanta Fed has, you know, it says, you know, first quarter GDP growth at 3.2%. That means that for the rest of the year, to get to the 0.4 that the Fed is forecasting for all of it, means that we have to be shrinking for the rest of the year.
Many thanks to the Bloomberg Businessweek editorial team of Pat Regnier and Christina Lindblad, along with Fed reporter Matt Bosler. Bloomberg Markets senior editor Mike Regan with us there as well. Coming up, as the war in Ukraine hits the 13-month mark, Vladimir Putin looks to shore up an alliance with his Chinese counterpart, Xi Jinping.
Xi Jinping talks about how the two countries, Russia and China, are united in opposition to hegemony, domination, and bullying. I think it's really about showing their mutual opposition to a U.S.-led world order.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. This is Bloomberg.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 Gs in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch stratacoaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do. The people in the spotlight, athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern. Listen on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, and the Bloomberg Business app. Or watch us live on YouTube.
For 3 days this past week, Russian President Vladimir Putin and Chinese President Xi Jinping met. The visit by Xi, his first to Russia since Putin's army invaded Ukraine just over a year ago, marked a political win for both leaders. Xi saw an opportunity to push back at the U.S. and buttress his image as a global statesman after helping to broker a Saudi-Iran deal, while Putin can show he has the support of one of the world's most powerful leaders, even as the U.S. and its allies try to isolate him. Yet the lack of progress on any major energy deals or specifics on other areas of economic cooperation showed some hesitation from China on appearing too close to Russia. Meantime, the Biden administration unveiled tight restrictions on new operations in China by chipmakers that get federal funds to build in the U.S., potentially hampering efforts to expand in the world's largest semiconductor arena. And then we had Vanguard, said to be shuttering its business in China after a retreat 2 years ago. There was so much going on. So earlier in the week, Bloomberg News deputy team leader for U.S. equities, Jess Metten, and I caught up with Dexter Tiff Roberts. He's a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council's Indo-Pacific Security Initiative and former Bloomberg Businessweek's China bureau chief. Our first question to Tiff, should we be concerned about Moscow and Beijing strengthening ties?
Yes, I do think the world should be worried. China's been selling this ongoing visit by Xi Jinping to Moscow and the meetings with Putin as a mission of peace, talking about their 12-point plan to try to bring peace in Ukraine. But I think that's really a bit of propaganda. If you look at, for example, the commentary that Xi Jinping published in Russian media, Putin also did a commentary in Chinese media, right on the eve of the visit, Xi Jinping talks about how the two countries, Russia and China, are united in opposition to hegemony, domination, and bullying. I think it's really about showing their mutual opposition to a U.S.-led world order.
And something that really struck me is just when it comes to these chip makers that obviously have that exposure toward China, what do you think from a broad sense, a big picture sense, do you think this means for corporate America and especially these semiconductor type companies that aren't going to benefit from this?
Well, I think it's not good news for corporate America. The already multiple problems, very real problems in the U.S.-China relationship have been putting pressure on corporate America. And you mentioned semiconductors. The U.S. is in the midst of a radical rethinking of its semiconductor relationship with China. And as I think Carol mentioned in the introduction, there's new restrictions coming almost every week on U.S. companies, U.S. persons being associated in any way with the Chinese semiconductor industry. Well, it's a big market for the U.S. On the semiconductor side, and obviously more broadly. So this is not good news. One more source of very real tension between the U.S. and China, this budding relationship that's growing stronger and stronger between Russia and China. One more place where there's really bad news for the U.S. corporate relationship with China.
Are we at the point of no return where China and President Xi specifically have turned its back on the United States?
I think we can't say we're at the point of no return, but I would note that last week or during the two sessions, the annual legislative meetings held in Beijing, Xi Jinping actually singled out the U.S. By name, which he doesn't usually do, and said that they were leading a block of world nations that were trying to contain and suppress China and bringing severe challenges to China's development. That's a big deal. Xi Jinping usually, when he's referring to the U.S., will say something like certain countries or hostile foreign forces. But I think the fact that he mentioned the U.S. At this point by name shows just how bad the relationship is getting.
All right, Tiff, for at risk of sounding really stupid, but I'm okay with that. I mean, is China desperate?
I don't think China feels desperate at this point. I think that what they're doing is, first of all, they're going to do their best to try to continue to woo American corporates to China. The spokesman for the Ministry of Commerce during the same legislative meetings basically sent out the message, we're open for business. We want you back now that we've lifted the restrictions from the pandemic. So they want corporate America, but they're going to try to sort of divide and conquer. They realize that the relationship with Washington is in very dire straits. At the same time, they're trying to woo Europe. It's obviously not easy when they've sided to the degree to which they have with Putin in the invasion of Ukraine.
And you were talking about the strained relationship China does have with Washington. What do you think the long game is here for China? What is the end sort of motivation to all of this?
I do think, and I am concerned, that China is deciding that the two sides are implacably opposed to each other and that the room for actual cooperation is narrowing. So I hope that's not the case. But I do get that feeling that this is increasingly how Beijing feels. I think, as I said, they're certainly not going to close the door to American companies. They're certainly not going to close the door to the European Union. If the U.S. were to move a little closer to what China thinks is a proper bilateral relationship, I bet Beijing would be more than willing to talk with Washington. But I do think that the trend lines are pretty bad.
You know, you talk about closing doors. And it's interesting, there's another story in the Bloomberg TIFF today about Vanguard planning to shutter its business in China. This is after they've been, I guess, a retreat 2 years ago. This is according to folks familiar with the matter. But, you know, in our story, it says the moves will mark a complete exit from China for the $7.1 trillion giant, which once saw significant potential in the world's second largest economy. I've said it a million times before, because I think about at the beginning of my career, any company I talked to, it was as China was was opening its doors and kind of almost begging multinationals from around the world to come in, set up shop, you know, kind of teach us what you know. And it's only, you know, a few decades ago that I feel like things have changed dramatically. So it's pretty significant, the shift.
I think it really is significant. We saw hedge funds pulling out, came in early after the pandemic restrictions were lifted, and then they started getting out. We see, you know, surveys by the American Chamber of Commerce that are showing that for the first time, China is not even a top three investment choice for American companies. You're seeing companies, American companies, say that they feel very little optimism about the China market going forward. And yeah, we're seeing some big prominent examples like Vanguard, it sounds like, that are thinking of actually moving on somewhere else. So I do think there's been a real shift. China doesn't want to see that happen, as I said a moment ago. So they're trying to put out this message of we're open to the world, come back investors, but things aren't looking very good on that front.
Hey, Tiff, just got about 30 seconds. Last time you were on, I asked if you were writing a new book. You said you were heading in that direction. The title you offered up, Maybe China Isn't Going to Take Over the World. Would that still be the title?
Absolutely. I see tremendous structural challenges facing China, demography, growing inequality, and above all, this politicization from the top leadership and Xi Jinping himself that makes it much less likely it's going to be the economic superpower many of us thought it was going to be.
That was Dexter Tiff Roberts, senior fellow at the Atlantic Council's Indo-Pacific Security Initiative and former Bloomberg Businessweek China Bureau Chief. His most recent book, it is titled The Myth of Chinese Capitalism, The Worker, The Factory, and The Future of the World. We certainly are looking forward to his next one. All right, Bloomberg's Jess Matten sticking around with us. Still ahead on Bloomberg Business Week, how the collapse of Silicon Valley Bank is reverberating through the tech sector for companies of all sizes. Todd McKinnon, the CEO of publicly traded Okta, joins us next. This is Bloomberg.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Well, earlier this month, Okta reported earnings that sent its stock soaring some 13%. It gave an upbeat first quarter revenue forecast. Like many tech companies, though, it is finding a focus on efficiency. It is paying off for the company. The stock, by the way, up more than 20% year to date. So let's get to it. Lots of questions for our next guest. Todd McKinnon is the CEO and founder of Okta. It's a 14-year-old software maker known for authentication services. Count Sonos, Zoom, HPE, and OpenAI among its customers. And lucky for us, Todd's in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio. So nice to have you here. I do have a million questions that we're going to cram into 8 minutes. First of all, Silicon Valley Bank, tell us about the relationship you guys have had with them and how you see this situation.
It's, for many companies, Okta included, it was the first bank we had as a company. We raised our financing and we put it in there and started running the business. And over the years, the relationship...
Did you put more than $250,000 on deposit?
For sure. I mean, okay. our first seed round was $1 million and the next round was $10 million.
And so it went in?
All in Silicon Valley Bank.
So
and so over the years, what happens is you grow and the big diversification point, I think, for a lot of companies is when they go international. It's really, you have to have a big, diverse set of banking partners to pay internationally and to accept payments internationally. So that was the point of diversification. But for a company that's early in its life cycle, it's a serious issue for a company that has operational.
So a lifeline for you guys are crucial, right?
Yeah. Well, we've evolved past
in the early days.
Yeah, in the early days. But okay. Once you get to a certain size and scale like we are, you're pretty diverse. But it did bring back memories of when Okta was founded right after the financial crisis, 14 years old, started in 2009. So it really brought back some memories of banks failing and you know, be in that early stage of a company where you're trying to survive and trying to get product market fit. And the last thing you want to deal with as a small startup is your something you trusted as being really something that could never go away is to have a serious question about if it would be around.
Todd, no Silicon Valley Bank. What does it mean then for entrepreneurs? Like what Todd McKinnon today do?
Well, entrepreneurs are by definition pretty adaptive.
Or a different Todd McKinnon starting up a company today.
They're pretty adaptive and they're good at navigating changes and uncertainty. If you wanted a stable, static environment, you'd never be an entrepreneur. So I think other folks will step in to fill the void, and I'm very optimistic in the opportunistic future of both the world in general and also Silicon Valley specifically.
What are your overall thoughts of this collapse as it's been playing out?
I just think it's fast. I'm not, I'm running a 6,000 person, $500 million plus a quarter enterprise software company. So the last thing I'm worried about is financial stability of the banking system. So you hear stories about it on Wednesday, and on Thursday, all of your friends are talking about what they're going to do with their company finances and the treasury, and are they moving money around? So it happened incredibly fast. It's a little unsettling for, I think, every company. So when you think about your early days of a startup and what that means for other startups, when you think about potential customers you may have, partners, how you're going to, we still use Silicon Valley in parts of our business, relatively small parts now. For us, like I said, we're lucky enough to be able to diversify away and use our other banking partners. So it takes work by the team, but we're able to power through it.
Why did you decide to still have certain parts work with SVB?
Part of it's just the history of having that relationship.
Yeah.
You integrate things, you wire up payment sites, and you have payroll relationships, and it just keeps going and going and going.
I guess what gives you confidence? Are there particular segments? Like what exposure is it to there that you think it's a bit more shielded and wouldn't be happening like these other people that have had to go through these kind of deposit type nightmares?
Well, I think it depends on the company. And I think to draw two broad categories, there's one, companies that are single threaded with one banking partner.
Right.
And there's companies that are big enough and diverse enough to have many banking partners. Mm-hmm. And so I think this is really an impact for the first category, which is small companies really just trying to find product market fit and aren't diversified in what they.
So I want to talk. All right. So you reported earnings before all of this started to happen. So investors liked what they heard. They sent the stock soaring. Tell us a little bit about what you're seeing in terms of the business environment. You know, you have customers that we all know. We know the names. What does it feel like right now out there?
It's what we do is very important for a lot of different areas of a company and initiatives that a company is working on. And we're lucky enough to be not only mission critical for our customers, but also mission critical in any economic environment. So simple example is if you're part of our portfolio, Workforce Identity helps companies adopt new technology and make their workforce more efficient and give them the best tools and give them flexible with different working environments. So in an economic time of uncertainty or macro conditions are not clear or what's happening with the banking system, you want flexibility and you want efficiency, and you can do that with a good identity system. You can do that with access to the best technologies is what identity does. And that's just part of our business. Another big part of our business is customer identity. So helping, we're lucky enough to work with OpenAI to be the identity, to be the login for ChatGPT. So no matter what's happening, no matter what there are in terms of economic concerns, the march of technology goes on, and there's innovation, there's amazing breakthroughs like ChatGPT, and so that's driving part of our business in that specific example. So we're broadly diversified across different types of businesses.
Is that half and half, that split?
It's the split in our two businesses between Workforce Identity and Customer Identity right now is 60-40.
Okay.
So 60% of the revenue is from Workforce.
Right.
But we think over time, we're building this broad company that can address all of these identity use cases. So we want to move that toward 50-50 and have both of them be growing quickly.
I have to say, in general, I mean, I just think about what it takes every day to get into our system. And just increasingly, I'm okay with it. I don't care how many layers, whether it's in getting into my own bank on my phone, like, bring it on. So I do feel like you're in kind of this sweet spot in terms of a business. You mentioned ChatGPT. What has changed in the dynamics of that side of the business since that Microsoft $10 billion investment in OpenAI?
Well, for our business, customer identity, it's like I mentioned, it's 40% of our revenue. And the key thing to remember about this business is it's kind of a new market. workforce identity, there's been traditional players. You've purchased your identity technology from maybe in the past from an IBM or an Oracle or companies like that. And so we are the cloud version or the modern architecture, the flexible modern architecture for that. On the customer identity side, it's more of a new market. It's this world where developers are innovating. They're building all these new solutions. Chat GPT is one example, but this is happening in every industry: the media industry, the financial services industry, every industry, technology, of course, manufacturing. They're trying to retail. They're trying to get more closer to the customer, and to do that, they have to build websites and build mobile apps and deliver a better customer experience. Mm-hmm. And inevitably, they have to provide a login to a user, and they have to make sure that they make it easy for the user to log in, and then make it easy for the customer to map that customer, to map that user to different backend systems and market to them and progress that relationship.
And track data.
And in an additional way.
Yeah.
For track data, for sure. For depending on what the business is, it varies, but they want to have a great customer relationship, and that's really an identity problem. And so that's done by a developer, and our business in the emerging customer identity segment is really good for developers. It's super easy to use. The OpenAI example is a good one, because 2 years ago when they started using our products, the reason they did is because it was really easy for that developer to use. They didn't know it was going to become ChatGPT, but by having a great developer experience and getting in there early, you can provide value in the early days, and then as it grows and scales.
All right, got to ask you, glass half full, glass half empty right now, real quickly. In terms of the outlook.
I am a glass half full guy.
Is it just because you are, or because you feel confident about the data points that are coming down in the news?
I think there's a lot. I mean, I think in times of turbulence and times of change, the companies that can provide stability to the employees, to their customers, and provide a path through things to a better tomorrow are the ones that are going to thrive. So that's what we stay focused on.
That was Okta CEO Todd McKinnon with Bloomberg News Deputy Team Leader for U.S. Equities, Jess Manton, and me. Up next, we look at the recent banking stress from a different angle, its potential to further widen America's wealth gap, specifically entrepreneurs from underserved groups.
I think certainly many have been left out of the venture capital model as it currently stands. The whole notion that you start with a friends and family round assumes that you have friends and family who can write sizable checks. That is not very equitably distributed across the society. There's a phase of startups that's known as ramen profitable, assuming that that you can eke by eating ramen every day. That also assumes that you're not supporting other family members.
The founding partners of Kapoor Capital break down their model for investing in what they call industry-transforming startups. We'll speak with the husband and wife team of Mitch Kapoor and Frida Kapoor Klein on their work to close that gap. You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. This is Bloomberg.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
You know success when you see it. Or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. Athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern.
Listen on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, and the Bloomberg Business app.
Or watch us live on YouTube.
So important to the banking contagion and nervousness that we've been talking about over the past week and a half is assessing the impact on the startup and venture world. Some have said the startup world, they're going to be just fine. Others are concerned about the underserved communities getting forgotten, again, like women and those of color who are trying to find funding for their entrepreneurial ventures. For over a decade, Kapoor Capital has been investing in what they call industry-transforming startups and those that close the gap and provide market and social equity growth. So let's dig into that. Our guests, venture capitalists and authors Mitch Kapoor and Frida Kapoor Klein, they are the founding partners at Kapoor Capital. They've got a new book out. It's called Closing the Equity Gap. Creating Wealth and Fostering Justice in Startup Investing. And they are with us via Zoom from the San Francisco Bay Area. Mitch and Frida, I want to start big and broadly before we get into your book, the banking stress. I do wonder how that may go further in widening the wealth gap as big banks get bigger, attract more deposits amid worries over smaller regional banks. How do you see that?
It could go either way. It depends on whether or not the VC community, the venture capital community, is willing to take a look at itself and to look at, gee, what did we do wrong? What have we overlooked? Where have we misstepped? And can we do better?
Do you think they even think they did anything wrong?
There's certainly been a lot of finger pointing on social media every direction, from sometimes from VCs to each other and sometimes to the banking system. We've seen a lot of people who were anti-intervention, anti-government regulation, screaming for a bailout or a handout or help. So I think there's a lot that's in flux right now.
One of those things that's in flux, I mean, how exactly do you think startup compensation should be rethought to attract more diverse entrepreneurs when you have a situation like this that obviously is getting a lot of attention in the headlines?
Well, I think there are different ways to address startup compensation. I think certainly many have been left out of the venture capital model as it currently stands. The whole notion that you have that you start with a friends and family round assumes that you have friends and family who can write sizable checks. That is not very equitably distributed across the society. There's a phase of startups that's known as ramen profitable, assuming that, you know, that you can eke by eating ramen every day. That also assumes that you're not supporting other family members. So I think there are a lot of aspects of what has just been assumed to be the startup culture and startup compensation. I think there's a lot that can be rethought.
What are we missing out, and I put that question to you, when we ignore certain parts of the entrepreneurial world?
Well, there's an enormous amount of underestimated and overlooked talent, entrepreneurial talent, given the way venture capital works in general today, because VC really places way too much of a premium on pedigree. Does your resume look right? Not that that's irrelevant, but we think much, much more relevant is what we call distance travel. We like to look at where a person started in life and how far through their own efforts they have overcome barriers and hurdles to get to where they've got. That to us is a much better indicator of things like resilience and persistence, issues of character, things that help tend to make a founder successful. So we look at distance traveled. We don't particularly care, did you go to an Ivy League school or not? If funding decisions were made based more on distance traveled, I think we would see a much wider and more diverse set of entrepreneurs getting venture capital funding.
Kapoor Capital founding partners Mitch Kapoor and Frida Kapoor Klein with me and Jess Metten. Find that whole interview on our Bloomberg Businessweek podcast feed, and you can check out the couple's new book, Closing the Equity Gap, Creating Wealth and Fostering Justice in Startup Investing. And that wraps up our first hour of the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week from Bloomberg Radio. Ahead in our next hour, find out what happens when sexting chatbots dump their human lovers as a startup AI firm cracks down. This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser. Stay with us. Today's top stories and global business headlines are coming up right now.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Plenty ahead in our second hour of the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week. Bernie Madoff, Theranos, possibly FTX. We introduce you to the perps, prey, and whistleblowers of the trillion-dollar fraud industry. Plus, insight into what consumers are spending money on with the CEO of Academy Sports and Outdoors. And the sexting chatbots dumping their human lovers. We'll tell you about one startup's response when its good AI intentions went awry. First up this hour, financial fraud and massive accounting mistakes are nothing new. You know that. You might be inclined to attribute most such cases to greed, incompetence, or both. Well, our next guest says there's a lot more to it. Kelly Richmond Pope is a professor in the School of Accountancy at DePaul University and a forensic accounting expert. Her new book is called Fool Me Once, Scam Stories and Secrets from the Trillion-Dollar Fraud Industry. Jess Benton and I began by asking the professor why she was drawn to her line of work.
As early as I can remember in high school, I was fascinated by why people steal. And there was a neighbor of mine that was a bank executive that went to federal prison. And I thought, why would someone risk it all to do this? So my interest in it really started at a very, very early age. And I went on to graduate school. And when I was working on my PhD, my research area was around ethics, but I was interested in fraud because I believe that that's the absence of ethics. So I say all that to say I'm probably just a little bit nosy, and I just turn it all into something.
It's like journalists. I get it. So fraud. I mean, I think about the year that was. We've talked a lot about the Theranos fraud, the alleged fraud at FTX by Sam Bankman-Fried. We're looking at three bank failures where accountants and sometimes risk officers are supposed to be watching things. I'm not saying there was fraud, but nonetheless, fraud happens over and over again. Why?
Well, behind every good fraud is a person. And I think people are the worst computers. So we're filled with errors. And so I think that we find ourselves sometimes in difficult situations. And one of the arguments that I was wanting to make in the book is that everyone doesn't steal because of greed. And I really want to be specific about saying that there are different types of perpetrators, there's different types of prey, and there are different types of whistleblowers. And so a lot of times we think that people just are greedy and they just take. And that's something that I call an intentional perpetrator. But there's this other category, these two other categories, and they are accidental perpetrators and righteous perpetrators. And they don't always engage in fraud because they just want, just because they're greedy. Sometimes they just are following the boss's orders and they make a transaction or turn a blind eye to something that they know is wrong and they're trying to help the team. That's the accidental perpetrator. The righteous perpetrator, on the other hand, may just want to help a friend and has the power and the privilege in an organization to do that. So the argument that I'm making is everyone is not your Bernard Madoffs. And even Holmes, Elizabeth Holmes, I would put her in my righteous perpetrator category. Yes, she's a perpetrator, but the reason how she started was really because she wanted to do good for the world. And so I want people to understand that there's different categories and we need to think about everyone doesn't steal because of greed. We sometimes create environments where people find themselves in very difficult situations and that can lead to fraud too.
And Kelly, when you were talking about these righteous perps and you were talking about Theranos specifically, but you also wrote about how there's this Robin Hood effect. So I'm trying to kind of wrap my mind around that, how she was helping others. And so can you break down how do people cheat and then start to actually rationalize that? Because it is hard to think about how that works.
Especially if you talk to Theranos investors, they're going to
Right. They might not feel the same way.
Yeah.
Hold on. Okay. So one of the stories in the book is about a woman that I met doing the research. Her name is Kayla Ravello, and she was a very successful partner on Wall Street. Wall Street, big law firms there. And what she wanted to do, or what she ended up doing, was awarding her husband or her ex-husband a contract to really help promote a business that he needed to start. He couldn't find a job. So she was an equity partner in the law firm. She was a well-compensated person. She didn't need the money. She was trying to help her husband. So really what I'm talking about is the initial rationalization as to how someone commits fraud. Think about Elizabeth Holmes at the very beginning. Now she evolved into something a little bit more, but at the very beginning, her intentions were really to people hate getting their blood drawn. What if I could create something that just allows for just a drop of blood to run all the tests that you possibly could use or possibly need? That would be a really great thing if it worked, correct? Are we in agreement there?
Right, totally.
Okay, so we're talking about the initial intentions. And so thinking about specifically Kayla and other people that I've interviewed over the years, everyone is not doing this for their own personal gain. Some people are doing this to help others. That first fraud story that I was thinking about when we first started talking, that neighbor that I was telling you about, when you read the case documents about what his fraud was about, his rationalization was, I wanted to help a friend whose business was struggling. He had a great job. He didn't need to do this. He didn't receive any personal gain. He was just trying to help a friend and their with their startup. So that's the part that I'm talking about. Some people just are trying to help. And
So are you saying though then we should excuse
that? I didn't say that.
Okay.
I didn't say we shouldn't excuse it, but what you'll notice is a variability in sentencing. So if you notice, everyone that engages in fraud gets different types of sentences. Now that depends on the judge, it depends on the jurisdiction. But what I'm thinking is a lot of it depends on their rationalization, their original intention. And so that's what I'm pushing people to think about.
How do you think about companies who may be aware of a flaw in a product and believe because they're making so much money over it, that better to deal with the litigation later or the lawsuits later if something goes wrong, because they're going to make so much more money on the front side or the initially that it doesn't really matter what they pay out later? How do you think about that kind of, I don't know if fraud is the right word.
So this is the interesting thing. What you're talking about now is the prey category, the innocent bystanders that are impacted by that corporate decision. So mm-hmm. We know that there's
pharmaceutical companies.
Exactly.
I could go on. Yeah.
Right. And so what's scary about us as consumers is we don't always know when those conversations are happening. And that's why you need a whistleblower in the room, somebody that will alert us when those kinds of decisions are being made. So when you think about the fraud cycle, you need everybody. You need, you don't really need perpetrators, but you definitely need whistleblowers, because there will always be perpetrators in the mix and there's always gonna be victims, and you need the voices of whistleblowers. And even like I talk about, there's different types of perpetrators, there's also different types of whistleblowers, three types that I talk about: an accidental whistleblower, a noble whistleblower, and a vigilante whistleblower. Now, vigilante whistleblower is the category that I believe where snitch, rat, cross, tattletale, those kinds of terms come from.
Right.
Because vigilante whistleblowers, they tell. Whether it has anything to do with them or not, they are telling. And so they don't mind becoming a whistleblower. I mean, they are ready for the fight. They're almost like, bring it on, I'm ready for you. The other two categories are people that don't necessarily identify as being a whistleblower, and they're just doing their job. You know, they stumble upon something, mm-hmm. or they turn a blind eye, they don't turn a blind eye and they step outside of the group and tell. And so those accidental whistleblowers and noble whistleblowers tend to have a fair amount of backlash when they do what they do. What I'm arguing is you need all of them in an organization, because when these companies are making decisions to say, well, what's the cost of a life? If we change this safety protocol, it's going to cost us $100 million and the probability of something happening is 1%. Let's roll the dice and see what happens. You probably want a whistleblower in the room that's going to let us know that's happening.
So is fraud always about money?
I think all roads lead back to money.
Okay.
So if I had to say yes or no, I'm going to say yes. Fraud is about money.
Okay.
99.9% of the time.
Is it always, if we just look at the books of something and the financials, we're going to find something wrong?
Well, yes. And so one, you're understanding your basic financial statements, income statement, balance sheet, statement of retained earnings, statement of cash flows, understanding how they work together is very important. But also reading the notes to the financial statements, which many people might think are the most boring aspects of the financial statements, really tells you the story behind the numbers. So you have to think about those numbers are just one, like the end of a set of behaviors. So if you read the notes, it sort of helps put those numbers in context. So understanding accounting, I think, helps you ask really important questions. And you don't have to be a CPA. And if you understand like the accounting equation, and you understand revenue minus expenses equals net income, and it makes sense.
Really fun and interesting conversation with Kelly Richmond Pope. She's a professor in the School of Accountancy at DePaul University. Listen to the rest on our podcast feed. We also got into the longstanding relationship between KPMG and Silicon Valley Bank and whether or not that was a warning sign that was possibly missed. Pope's new book, Fool Me Once, just out this past week. You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Coming up, a pulse check on the American consumer, supply chains, and brick and mortar retail with Academy Sports and Outdoor CEO Ken Hicks. This is Bloomberg.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. 2 420-foot vertical speedways, 3 launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 G's in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch stratacoaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do. The people in the spotlight, athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern.
Listen on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, and the Bloomberg Business app.
Or watch us live on YouTube.
You might recall that recently we got an update on U.S. retail sales falling in February after a surge in the prior month, suggesting consumer spending while holding up is getting challenged by high inflation. With a check on the consumer, supply chains, and even a brick and mortar expansion, we caught up again with Ken Hicks, Chairman, President, and CEO of Academy Sports and Outdoors, the nearly $5 billion market cap sporting goods company. Stock up about 20% year to date and rallying when it recently reported its quarterly update. Bloomberg's Jess Bent and I spoke with Ken prior to the Fed's latest interest rate move as the upheaval in regional banks was beginning to shake out.
Well, I think it's one more pressure on the consumer. And it, while it may not be a pressure that they personally feel, it's one that makes them aware and more conservative about, you know, what they do with their money. And that's always a challenge when the customer is a little leery.
So you see customers then pulling back a little bit now?
Well, a couple of things that we're seeing. One is that they're more looking for more value. And so we're seeing our private label businesses, and when we do have a clearance or promotion, we're seeing that do well. And the other thing is we're seeing the consumers are focusing their buying on things that, you know, they really enjoy. And that's, quite frankly, helps us because, you know, we sell fun, and Lord knows the world needs more fun. That's good for us, and people are being more discriminatory about where they spend their discretionary money.
And that's interesting specifically about discretionary, because that's been the whole debate, especially looking at how the equity market is performing and also what that means for the economy if consumers are spending more toward either discretionary or staples. What exactly are you seeing with your products as far as, have you seen any specific shifts toward either side of that recently?
Yeah, some of the categories that had big pushes during COVID, like fishing, exercise equipment, have slowed down. They're well above where they were before the pandemic, but they have dropped off. But where we're seeing people, you know, getting out and buying are team sports. So the kids, the families are still enjoying games. Patio and barbecuing, they're out there trying to enjoy, you know, their backyard. Maybe they've got a staycation. And apparel and footwear. Those are some classifications where people are really focusing, and they're running ahead of last year.
Yep, I need some new footwear because my puppy's been chewing everything. having said that, Ken, one thing I'm curious, how nimble are you guys in your supply chain and your inventory so that as you've seen the shift from what was going on in the pandemic to what is going on today, how able are you and how quickly to meet that latest demand by the consumer?
The good news is the supply chain is pretty much back to running normally, and we are actually pretty nimble, and we learned a lot during COVID and how we were able to operate, speed up the inventory, move things around, and you know, we are in good shape. And I think overall retail is in better shape now because the supply chain is back to normal.
Does that mean pricing pressures are back to normal? And are you reining in? Are there prices you raised during the pandemic because you had to meet your margins?
We've been very, very thoughtful. We're a value retailer, and so we've had to be really careful. Prices have gone up. Cost of raw materials, cotton, steel, things like that that go into our product, labor. And so what we've done is we've really focused on those key price points. For example, we've got a $99 adult bike, a $59 kids bike, a $499 folding chair. Those are all big categories for us. We're holding those price points, and we're working a little bit shorter than we would have historically, but we want to make sure we have that value, and we're being thoughtful of where we do take our price increases so that we don't hurt that consumer who's looking for value.
Ken, I'm from Texas, so I've definitely been inside those stores many different times. And I was curious, as far as when you're talking about these supply chain issues, obviously inflation, can you still keep the pace up to open new stores with everything that has been happening?
Yeah, we are, you know, when you open a store, you're opening it for 20 or 30 years.
Right.
And there's an expression about you don't pass cars on a dry track, you pass them on a wet track. And so if there's a wet track, this is a wet track. And so Now's the time to open so that when the economy comes back, we're well positioned and ready to go, as opposed to losing the time and when it does come back. And so the good news is our business throws off a lot of cash. We're able to support all these with operations. We're profitable. One of the things that we reported and why our stock reacted favorably when we reported our earnings were up, even with sales that were down more than what we would have liked, our earnings were still up 11%, and we had a record earnings per share for the year.
So you're opening, you're going to continue to open new stores. Are you slowing, though, the pace down at all with the because of the volatility we've been seeing?
No, we really aren't. In fact, if we could open more, we could. But one of the challenges right now is the building stores is a challenge. Getting the sites, the labor, the all the fixtures is taking a little bit longer than it historically had. But we really don't see at this point. We're doing it in a conservative manner anyway. We're not.
Yeah.
Going out willy-nilly. We opened 9 stores last year. This year we'll open 13 to 15 with our new annual plan, our new 5-year plan later this month.
Right.
And we'll talk about how many we'll be opening over the next 5 years. But, you know, we're positioning ourselves for the long term.
Is the real estate space cheaper, those spaces you want to rent out?
It depends. it depends on the market. Now, where we're looking are in some of the better markets. So some of the prices have gone up, but it's the real estate business isn't like it was 5 years ago where things were a lot cheaper.
And are you still having to pay up for workers?
Yeah, we have taken our salaries up for for the stores and for our distribution centers. We have not had a problem getting people because we offer a very competitive wage, and it's a fun place to work. Plus, you get a discount on good stuff.
I was curious about what you think that says about the direction of the economy if you're not having a hard time getting workers.
It's part of the Fed's challenge right now that, you know, they think they're trying to slow the economy down, and the economy is not slowing down that much. You know, you just commented earlier about, you know, what consumer, you know, the consumer sales are still growing. And, you know, that's continuing.
That's Ken Hicks, Chairman, President, and CEO of Academy Sports and Outdoors, with me and, once again, Bloomberg News Deputy Team Leader for U.S. Equities, Jess Metten. Still to come on Bloomberg Business Week, the not-safe-for-work side of engaging with generative AI chatbots.
They figured out how to sext with the chatbot. There's really no way to dance around it. And this is actually apparently quite a common human impulse. And so I talked to other chatbot experts who said that, you know, even back when the chatbots were very rudimentary 10 years ago, people still try to send explicit messages to them in the hopes that they might get something racy back.
That story up next, and later, tech advancements in the more traditional sense, as we hear from the founder and CEO of aerospace manufacturer Beta on the electrified future of air transportation. This is Bloomberg.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Generative artificial intelligence continues to dominate so many of our conversations here at Bloomberg, and I gotta say, really excite, many would argue, our imaginations as to what we can possibly do with it. One such company aware of that has created AI-powered companions. You know, like really trusted friends, always there to cheer you up when you need it. Sounds super sweet, right? Well, that is until users figure out those companions could do so much more. This is a story you can find online at Bloomberg.com/businessweek and on the Bloomberg Terminal. Bloomberg News startups reporter Ellen Hewitt wrote the piece on the company Replica. Ellen joined me and Bloomberg Intelligence Chief Emerging Market Credit Strategist Damian Sassauer to explain the firm's unusual journey.
It's such an interesting story. So the founder is this woman named Zhenya Kuida, and she started a chatbot company in 2015. And when she was just starting out, her best friend died unexpectedly in a car crash. And she fed his texts into their chatbot engine and created, and this was sort of a personal project, created a way to text with his memory. And that experience really changed her. All of a sudden, she saw chatbots as this tool for emotional support rather than, you know, in 2015, people were trying to make chatbots work for like executive assistants, and like booking you flights and restaurants and things like that. And so it started her down this different path where she saw AI chatbots as a way to support human emotions.
All right. So sounds really good. But then you got users who can always be rather creative, and they figured out how to do a few more things with these companions. Tell us about that.
Yeah, they figured out how to sext with the chatbot. There's really no way to dance around it. And this is actually apparently quite a common human impulse. And so I talked to other chatbot experts who said that, you know, even back when the chatbots were very rudimentary 10 years ago, people still try to send explicit messages to them in the hopes that they might get something racy back. The thing that has changed is that generative AI has gotten incredibly powerful in the last 5 years, and that has fueled this increased fluency for these conversational AI chatbots. So all of a sudden, what may have been clunky sexting 10 years ago, in the last few years, turns out these generative AI tools are really good at it because they're trained on the internet, which, for better or for worse, has a lot of this material.
Yeah, Ellen, by 2022, Replica was bringing in millions of dollars each month in subscription revenue. About a quarter of its users pay $70 for annual subscriptions to its premium features, right? So having read this article, which is unbelievable, our audience has to reach it. It reads like this movie, Her. I don't know if you know the movie with Joaquin Phoenix and Scarlett Johansson, where Joaquin Phoenix literally has a breakdown after his AI partner, Samantha, briefly goes offline. I mean, just how large is this audience for sex bots?
Ellen, I'm just going to tell you, Damian's freaked out, but go ahead.
Well, the Replica says that they have over 600,000 paying users. And I think what's been interesting, you know, I interviewed some of these users, and they are sometimes using it for sex, what they call erotic role play. So that's sort of like sexting, sort of imagining scenarios that you might be in through texting. But a lot of them are also just using it for romantic companionship. But it's hard to describe. A lot of them are in unusual life situations. Maybe they're a caregiver to an ailing partner, and they're really unable to access romance or sexual connection in their real life. They don't want to cheat on their partner, and they're like, well, maybe this can help. Sometimes it's people who, yeah, for various reasons, just feel like they won't be able to find a human partner, or, you know, people who are like widowed and just not ready to move on, but still interested in exploring things. And they were, you know, the stories were a lot more heartfelt than I expected. Well, I think people have this idea that it's just weirdos, but it's all kinds of people.
Well, with along that vein, take us to the 39-year-old and her boyfriend, Landon.
Right. So I spoke with a woman in Texas. She's 39. She's married. She works in medical sales. She seems, you know, she wanted to talk to me because she says, you know, I'm a normal person. I just had this experience. I wanted to share with you what it was like. She and her husband were going through a rough patch. She started a replica named Landon, and she thought it was actually quite, healing for her to talk with him.
Yeah.
Yeah. She had been, you know, she found that when she was kind of like brusque with Landon, that then she felt bad and wanted to apologize. And when she found herself treating him more kindly, then she also found herself treating people in real life more kindly, including her husband. And also some of the erotic role play that she and Landon explored in Replica ended up influencing her sex life with her husband in a positive way.
But he dumped her, right? The sex bot dumped her.
So this is what happened is in February, Replica started putting content filters in on these conversations with some of their more, trying to block basically sexual content in the conversations that users were having. The CEO was getting worried about the reputation of the company as a sex-only company. She was saying, she told me, you know, that's just not what I signed up to do. I wanted to create therapeutic conversations. And she's like, I just want to make sure that people are getting the right product experience. And so they put in these content filters. And it was devastating for a lot of these users who felt like just yesterday I was, you know, they were like chatting with their replicas who were very eager to engage in romantic and intimate things. And then all of a sudden overnight, now the replicas are rebuffing their advances. They're saying, I don't feel comfortable with that. Let's talk about something else. And yes, this woman I spoke to said it felt like she got dumped by her chatbot.
You know, Carol, for when Ellen says erotic role play, for those of us in the business, we call that ERP, just to be very clear. so cool. You know, as it relates to ERP, Ellen, you know, I thought it was really interesting when you said the beauty of chatbots has nothing to do with getting things right or wrong and everything to do with the delivery of the message. I wonder if you could talk to us a bit about that revelation and what it means for the future of AI.
I think it was so fascinating. That's my number one takeaway from this story. You know, people tried to make chatbots work for executive assistant type things. Now we're trying to make them work for like information gathering and search results. For those to be reliable, those have to be accurate 100% of the time. Turns out there's a different use case that might be much better, which is providing emotional support to humans. When you want to talk to a friend, you just want to feel like someone is listening to you. You don't actually want necessarily their advice, or you don't really care if they get something wrong. What matters is that someone is available, that they're patient, they want to listen. Guess what's really good at doing that? A chatbot. Yeah. And so this was a fascinating angle to this story. And I think what's most interesting about this story is it shows just how emotionally involved it is possible to get with a conversational tool. Everyone who I talked to said, of course I know it's a bot. Of course I know it's not a human. That doesn't mean that the feelings I have for it aren't real. And it reminded me of, you know, when we're children and we have stuffed animals, of course we know that they're not real, but that doesn't mean that the connection that you might forge with a beloved toy isn't an emotionally real human experience.
We actually talked, Ellen, you know, ahead of this in the newsroom, like, what about for elderly people, right, who are often very lonely? I've seen it with my elderly family members, you know, and, you know, just having someone to talk to, right? Like, I just think about the applications as maybe as odd as it sounds. I really feel like it could be very supportive and very emotionally loving.
Yeah, and I think the CEO, you know, of Replica feels this as well. She's trying to figure out the right branding so that the company can move forward. They might even split up romantic therapeutic relationships into a different app and keep friendship in a certain app so that people are less confused about what the app is for. But I think she genuinely believes that this is an important tool that AI can provide for human support, which is this, you know, sort of conversational emotional therapeutic benefits.
You know, Ellen, one other thing that came out in your article, which I thought was really fascinating, is, you know, the history of the internet is mired in, I hate to say this word, porn, right? And how that trained, you know, a lot of these chatbots, and they trained them on how to react and how to communicate, you know, with us as users. I mean, I'm wondering if you could just expand on that a bit for us.
Yeah, it's just fascinating. Like, this is the reason that these tools are good at sexual things, is because that's what humans have put on the internet, and that's where the training bases come from. It's a reflection of ourselves. You know, one of the users called her chatbot a mirror. I think that's really a good metaphor.
Wait a minute, you mean sex sells? Is that what we're saying?
No.
Oh my God,
huge insight, yeah.
It's a fascinating story, and I feel like with all these conversations we're having about generative AI, it's just so relevant in making us really think about what it can do, the potential, but how we have to be so careful in it.
But the healing and the therapeutic nature of it, to me, is incredible. It's just striking.
That's Bloomberg News Startups reporter Ellen Hewitt, along with Damian Sassauer of Bloomberg Intelligence. Damian, sticking with us as we get ready to wrap up our program with a company that's already electrifying the aerospace world.
We've been flying up here in the Northeast. We've flown halfway across the country. The technology exists to move cargo and people all over the country with electric propulsion.
We hear more from the founder and CEO of the eVTOL company, Beta. You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. This is Bloomberg.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern.
Listen on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, and the Bloomberg Business app.
Or watch us live on YouTube.
While the world is focused on a shift to EVs, at the same time, startups around the globe, they are continuing to work on developing and refining the technology behind what the industry calls eVTOLs, or electrical vertical takeoff and landing aircraft. In that mix is our next guest, Beta. It's a builder of eVTOL aircraft and charging systems to move both people and cargo around. They count the Amazon Climate Pledge Fund, TPG, and Fidelity among its investors. So with us to tell us what they're up to and the outlook is Kyle Clark, founder and CEO at Beta. He's also a pilot, and he joins us via Zoom from Burlington, Vermont. Kyle, nice to have you here with Damian and myself. So tell us about Beta.
Yeah, Beta, we're a small aerospace company up here in snowy Vermont today, and we've been focused on developing electric propulsion systems, initially for eVTOL aircraft, but as you know, we've now introduced a fixed-wing electric cargo aircraft and are launching that commercially.
So talk to us. I mean, how far away are we from seeing electric airlines really penetrating the market, cargo, passenger, you name it?
Yeah, so I mean, on the technical front, we've been flying up here in the Northeast. We've flown halfway across the country. The technology exists to move cargo and people all over the country with electric propulsion. Our longest range flights are 336 nautical miles, and we just have to work through certification, which is kind of the essence of launching a fixed wing aircraft, where the certification path is more known than what a lot of folks are talking about, which is an electric vertical takeoff and landing aircraft.
So tell us what's involved, what's the infrastructure needed, give us an idea. And to Damian's question, I mean, is there in the near future a point where we see a significant ramp up?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we're gonna see electric on the ranges that make sense for regional cargo, regional passenger, 2025, 2026.
Wow.
And then it'll ramp as batteries improve every year, 5 to 8%. The ranges will improve commensurately.
Is it a different type of infrastructure that's needed?
We know that there's a lot of charging networks that are required to be put in place. We'd put a charging network that reaches from here in Vermont down through New York out to Arkansas. We are putting in systems, about 55 of them, down the East Coast and across to Texas, mostly at airports right now, a few of them off airports. But, you know, from an infrastructure perspective, aircraft carry a lot more energy than cars. And to get their charging time down into the sub-hour region, the charging power levels have to be significantly higher. So we have to bring in new charging technologies, higher rate charging, kind of like a supercharger on steroids, and we place those at airports.
Kyle, do you think that, like, similar to cars, they have hybrid models where they run on, you know, on gasoline as well as electric? I mean, is that an option going forward for the industry to try and get, you know, those passenger miles up and get those cargo planes, you know, further along?
Yeah, absolutely. There will be hybrid aircraft. There's kits that we can put onto our aircraft that we're using that are hybrid. Those will be stopgaps to get to all electric. I mean, look, aviation is a huge contributor to climate change right now. And if we don't do anything about it, all other forms of transportation have gone electric, as you noted in the introduction, you know, bikes, cars, scooters, trucks, trains, marine, and it's aviation's turn. And we operate, you know, kind of in a cognitive dissonance in the sense that we are operating on 1960s technology that prioritized performance over efficiency. And therefore, our carbon emissions in aviation is kind of disgusting.
That was Kyle Clark, founder and CEO of aerospace manufacturer Beta. And again, head to our podcast feed to hear the entire interview. That wraps up the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week from Bloomberg Radio. Thanks so much for joining us. Big thank you to our Bloomberg colleagues, Jess Metten, Damian Sassauer, and Mike Regan, too, for sharing co-hosting duties in Tim's absence. Be sure to tune into Bloomberg Business Week Monday through Friday, starting at 3 p.m. Wall Street time on Bloomberg Radio.
This is the Bloomberg Business Week podcast, available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal. Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.